This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Michael Armbrust, Principal Software Engineer at Databricks.
Hi. I first got involved with big data in the Spark space when I helped create the first version of Spark SQL in Apache Spark. And I am now a member of the Spark PMC and also the tech lead at Databricks for both structured streaming and also this new project called Databricks Delta. Delta is solving this problem in the big data space of ACID transactions. It's something that we've known were valuable ever since traditional relational databases for the last 60 years. But up until very recently, this wasn't available inside of Apache Spark. And without ACID transactions, it's just very difficult for people to reason about the correctness of their data pipelines. All of these problems of partial failures or people concurrently modifying the same data set at the same time are all left up to you as the programmer. And so what Delta does is this transactional storage layer that integrates deeply with Apache Spark and gives you a scalable transaction log. So it both gives you these nice ACID properties, but it does it in a way where it preserves the parallelism and scaling properties of Apache Spark.
You've just done something really interesting with this. First of all, not only have you made this open source, but you've just thrown it at the Linux Foundation and said, here, deal with it. Why?
Yeah, that's a great question. Open source has been in the blood of Databricks since our inception. We're the original creators of Apache Spark. That's been very successful for us. I think really what we like to do is we like to build communities around our products. That works for everybody. It means that they're not locked into one particular vendor, and it also means we have this great funnel of people bringing their programs that they've already written using our APIs to our salespeople. It's great for everybody on both sides. With Delta Lake, this started as a proprietary product inside of Databricks. And we had a bunch of users using it for quite a while, but at some point we realized many organizations, if they're going to store petabytes of data in some place, data has a lot of gravity, it has a lot of inertia. You don't want to have all of that in some black box proprietary format where you're locked in. Back in April, we decided to open source the project and put it out with a full Apache license. And that's great, that's one way to do open source, but we're pretty committed to actually building a community around this and really making it the standard for doing transactions in data lakes. We think the Linux Foundation is just a fantastic vendor-neutral permanent home for the project where we can really foster the growth of this community.
One of the challenges with open source is we have different models of how this works. Some vendors acquire a piece of software, they promise the community they'll support it, and they build an enterprise version, and that's where they make their money from. Others just create a piece of software, as we did from the 1990s onwards, throw it out there and say, hey, get on with it. But the problem with that, if you're a commercial company, is no matter how interesting it looks, you don't have the time to mess with this. How are you going to balance the two here?
I have kind of a pretty strict rubric for how I think about open source and proprietary value. I think all APIs need to be open. Anything that's required to correctly run your program and get an answer, that should be available both inside of some proprietary version and also in open source. And where I think Databricks can add value on top of this is we can take those open APIs that everybody can build their applications on top of, and we can make them easier to use by pre-installing them and configuring all of the clusters. We can make them faster by adding optimizations so you can lower your total cost of ownership by requiring fewer machines to do the same computation, and also deep integration with the cloud. Cloud-specific optimizations, so it works really well with specific storage systems or other features that are available on different clouds.
One of the dangers of letting everybody run with this is that we run the risk of forks appearing. We run the risk of code starting out the same and disappearing. I'm old enough to remember Unix. I'm old enough to remember a whole bunch of projects where we started out in this approach. And very quickly, things became impossible to work with. We had the same thing, but in so many different flavors. Actually, we couldn't move between them. We couldn't migrate data. We couldn't migrate our applications we built on it. It became a huge inhibitor to those projects. How do you prevent that here?
There's a couple of things. Just on a technical level, we started just a couple of weeks ago publishing the formal spec for how the Delta transaction log works. So now we can all agree on the order of operations and how different entries in the transaction log resolve with each other. On a higher level, this was really one of our primary goals of joining the Linux Foundation. If this had just been some weird open source project at Databricks, it's very likely that other people were going to develop similar things and you wouldn't be able to interoperate. But our goal of donating the project to the Linux Foundation, really creating this sub-foundation in Linux is a place where everybody can collaborate on this one artifact. We can agree on the APIs for exchanging data and try and prevent those forks. Now, I can't say for sure that that's going to work, but that was definitely the reason why we were so excited about working together with the Linux Foundation to do this.
But in the work you've done already, you've got a group of partners who are already creating additional solutions for people. Their integrations into third-party products, integrations into their own products. As you hand this over and more people get involved, what does it mean to them? Are they going to find themselves easily integrated into everybody's version? What's their relationship now?
To me, the kind of core abstraction here again is the transaction log. That's the thing. If you want to be able to correctly read a large collection of data that's stored in Delta, that's the magic. And then all of these different systems can have different connectors that take advantage of the particular benefits of this system. In Spark, we have unified streaming and batch. There are APIs for both of those for connecting into Delta. In something like Hive, where we're working with Alibaba and others to build a connector there, of course, that's only going to be a batch connector because that's Hive's specialty. But that doesn't mean they can't read data that was written from a stream into a Delta table. It just means you'll be using Hive mostly for batch operations. What we need to all agree on is this protocol for how do we describe the data? How do we describe changes to it? How do we describe transactions in it? And then allow all of the engines to do their cool things with that information.
One of the problems with a lot of people's big data at the moment is data quality. It's all over the place. They're so busy stuffing stuff in there that they don't really know what to do with it. They don't know if they can trust it. They've got duplication. They've got incomplete records. How do people start here to clean that up?
First of all, one of the things that Delta does is it gets rid of these distractions that you have when you don't have transactional properties. The two big ones are lack of atomicity. So when you're trying to do a data cleaning operation and it maybe fails in the middle, how do I clean up that failure? Well, that's taken care of automatically when you have atomicity. Either jobs complete entirely or they roll back entirely. So you never have to worry about partial failures anymore. The other core problem that people run into is consistency and isolation. If multiple people are modifying a data set at the same time, it's very difficult to reason about correctness. And what consistency and isolation do is it basically makes it seem as though you're going one at a time, operating on the data entirely separately, even though you're actually doing it at the same time. And so that frees you up to focus on what cleanliness means in your particular domains. You can use the tools of Spark Data Frames or SQL to clean the data without having to think about these other things.
But cleaning data is not simple. We have applications that don't complete. We have users that can't fill out fields properly. We have developers who don't know how to bound the field correctly. But more importantly than that, if we're going to use this data for anything meaningful, we need to set data quality standards. Is it 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%? And when that data comes from so many different sources, it's a mess. We were talking before the podcast, and you were talking about bronze, silver, and gold standards. Can you elaborate a bit more?
What I notice is when people stop thinking about these systems problems and start focusing on the data quality problem, they start to think about quality classes. This is a way for them to communicate within an organization about what state data is in, because you're never going to always have clean data. It's never going to start that way. What I see is people start with a bronze table or raw table where they actually just dump all of the garbage that they're collecting. Sometimes they even just take raw streams from Kafka and dump them in with no parsing at all.
So this is effectively their ETL stage one.
Yes, exactly. This is the first dumping ground. And the nice thing about this is with Delta's scalability, you can actually store massive amounts of data in the raw. So you can have retention for years and years and years. And you might say, why am I keeping everything? Well, I think there's actually a couple of reasons here. One is when you keep everything, you can actually go back and you can find things that you thought were worthless. And turns out later, oh, there actually is an analysis where that's very useful. And another thing is, if you don't do any parsing on the data, there's no bugs in your parser. So you can always go back to that original data if there was some mistake later in your pipeline and recompute it from scratch.
But this comes at a cost to companies. If we take an example of astronomy, where we've got telescopes out there pulling down 25 gigabytes of data a day, and we've got arrays of these, the reality is most of the time they're looking at a few hundred megabytes of real data. So they're being told to use edge computing and throw the rest of that away. What you're saying is don't throw it away, keep it, because you never know when you might need it.
Yeah, well, okay. I think there's definitely different points in the spectrum here. When you have human-generated data, that's almost always at a scale that you should consider keeping all of it. When you have machine-generated data, even within there, there's a spectrum. There's machine-generated data that's still pretty small, and then there's, you say, like telescopes or particle accelerators. I think in like particle accelerators, they literally cannot even get it into a computer. They have to filter it in hardware before you can even start considering putting it in a computer. So I'm not saying you will keep everything, but I'm saying saying you should keep as much as you can possibly afford. And the elasticity of the cloud is incredibly powerful here. S3 can absorb massive amounts of data very quickly. It's probably one of the cheapest ways to store it. Eventually, you will sift through it and delete it, but you can keep as much as you think is reasonable within your budget.
But what does this mean for things like compliance? Because one of the reasons we've been throwing a lot of data away lately is actually we don't want that. Because if we keep that data, we've got to adhere to this piece of compliance and that piece of compliance. Compliance equals cost. Compliance equals lawyers. Compliance equals lawsuits. How do people bring their compliance to bear early at this bronze stage?
The transactions here are a fundamental benefit that make it much easier to be compliant. Let me give a couple of examples. You mentioned GDPR. A pretty common case here is so you have a giant data lake where you've got a bunch of personally identifiable information, but when you get a DSR, data subject request, where they say, you need to remove all of my data, you have 30 days to comply. So I saw people who were not using Delta before this technology existed, and updating data in place is very scary. If that job crashes in the middle while you're cleaning up that data set, you don't know if you've corrupted the data set, if you've duplicated it, if you've missed some records, and then you're in trouble for that lawsuit you mentioned. The only thing they would do is every 30 days, they would take the entire data set and copy it, filtering out things. And as you can imagine, that is incredibly expensive to copy everything once a month. Delta has all kinds of tricks underneath the covers. We can do data skipping to very quickly identify which files might have information about this user. We can do column pruning to then actually verify these are the files that need to be rewritten. And then we have atomicity. So when we do that swap, when we rewrite those files to no longer contain that user's data, you're guaranteed that you go from one state where it's there to another state where it's gone in one atomic flip. And that makes it much easier to reason about the correctness.
What then becomes the difference between that bronze data and silver?
After you've got bronze, you use your favorite tools, SQL, data frames, etc., to clean it, filter it, augment it, parse JSON data into top-level columns, join it with other data sets, and you produce silver. Silver is the data that has been cleaned up and is closer to being ready for consumption, but is maybe not yet saying anything that is actually valuable to your business. But it's really useful to materialize that data set for a couple of reasons. One reason is that you might have multiple people in the organization who would find that valuable. And so by creating this materialized data set, they can all take advantage of that cleaning work that you did and start from there and not have to go all the way back to the bronze data.
Is this where we would start to see data scientists engaging as opposed to end users?
Yes, exactly. The really nice thing here is when you're talking about this in these quality levels, I see people actually label, this is a bronze table, this is a silver table. So you have some expectations about quality when you start looking at it. Another reason you materialize these silver tables, though, which I actually thought was really interesting, this surprised me, was debugging. When you have this data set that is materialized, you can actually run interesting queries over it. So when you get to the final step, the gold data, and something looks amiss, you don't have to guess what it is. You can actually go to the data set that produced that and use the full power of SQL to ask questions about it. How many distinct values actually are in this column? Or in how many rows is this value null? You can often find things that surprise you and use that to figure out what went wrong earlier in the pipeline.
At what point then do customers start to use external services? For example, if somebody's running a marketing database, they will want to make sure they don't send items to people who are dead or people who have moved house because that's a waste of time. They'll want to make sure they pick up people who moved into new houses who aren't necessarily on a lot of other people's mailing lists. They do that by connecting to people like Experian, connecting to various post office databases around the world. Do they start to do this at silver, or is that something that happens at gold? Is that where this separation comes between data scientist working and end user engagement?
Usually I think this is in the process of going from silver to gold that you're going to do that. So that then by the time you get to gold, this is, to the best of your knowledge, clean data that you can do reporting, machine learning, predicting directly on that data set without having to think about cleanliness anymore.
But we know data continually changes throughout our loop. We're continually re-importing the same data. How repeatable does this become? I mean, if I think of DevOps, is this sort of data ops?
This, again, is the really powerful thing about this architecture, especially when you think about it in the context of streaming. The reason for this is when you find, let's say, something changes in your analysis or you realize, oh, there was actually a mistake in my pipeline. Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, at the bronze level, you've retained all of that original data. So you actually can fix your code and recompute from scratch. And streaming does this very simply because the guarantee of a streaming query in Spark is that a streaming query will always return the same answer as a batch job run over the same data set. So when you start a new stream from scratch, it starts by taking a snapshot of that table at that moment that the stream started. It takes that snapshot and it breaks it up into a bunch of individual pieces and processes it incrementally. And when it gets to the end of that snapshot, it starts tailing the transaction log to incrementally process new data that has arrived since you started the query. So you actually end up with the answer as though you had run the query at the end, even though you were incrementally processing it. The really nice thing here is when you find a mistake or there's even a new analysis that you hadn't thought of before that you want to do, all you do is clear out the tables, create a new checkpoint, and restart the stream, and it will eventually reach the endpoint where you've got all that data now in place. When you take that in the context of the elasticity of the cloud, you can do really cool things. So when you do one of those big recomputations, backfilling from the beginning of time, scale up to 1,000 machines. Once it reaches that endpoint where it just starts tailing the transaction log and processing incrementally, scale it down to 10 machines so your costs are lower.
That's quite cool.
Yeah. One of our first customers who was using Delta, he came to me and he's like, this is the best pattern ever. This is why I'm sticking with this thing. I thought that was really interesting. We hadn't actually thought of that when we were designing it, that that would be so useful, all these technologies coming together.
One of the other reasons I mentioned data ops, and you've mentioned pipelines, is we're starting to get the security teams involved in the code side of the business. But actually, security has always been kept away from data. Given the choice, DBAs would keep everybody away from data. They'd build a couple of forts, maybe put some guns on the top. Ours, leave it alone. With pipelines and the idea of data ops where security can come in, are you seeing customers physically engaging with their security teams to say, hey, we've got compliance, we've got security, we've got breach concerns. Look at our pipeline. Are we running risks?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Architecture reviews with security teams are something we do all the time at Databricks. Because when you collect a lot of data about your customers or other people, it's your business's reputation on the line if there's a breach or you fail any compliance things. And so we regularly review architectures and make sure you're following best practices.
Customer comes along, they've got a big mass of data on site at this particular moment in time. They're going to move that data to the cloud. So they want a hybrid solution. Their biggest problem is how do they get all that data from site to the cloud? But it's not just that one-time movement of data. Data continues to arrive. So are you seeing customers building a hybrid solution that enables to keep some stuff on site, some in the cloud, and is the glue a mix of streaming and pipelines?
I've seen people try to do this hybrid thing, especially in the early days of the cloud when we first started Databricks. Pretty much everyone told us, it's silly that you guys are focusing on the cloud. Banks will never be in the cloud. Governments will never be in the cloud. And mostly that's actually been proven to be false. We've seen more and more workloads moving to the cloud. And in fact, I would argue that the security teams at Amazon and Azure and these other big clouds are probably better than the security teams at most companies. I do see people doing a hybrid thing, and I think that's a great incremental strategy. But the one thing I would caution you against is doing a lift and shift where you take exactly the same paradigms that you were using in your data center to the cloud. An example here is people have one giant cluster in their data center, and they'll have one giant cluster in the cloud, and that is losing the benefits of elasticity. What you really want to do is you want to take advantage of ephemeral clusters that you start up when you have something to be done and that you shut down when you're not using them anymore, because you can both scale much larger than you ever could, exactly like that backfill thing that I was talking about before. And also in the evenings when nobody's using it, you can pay nothing. Those two things together are magical. You can do hybrid deployments, but I would definitely encourage you not to lift and shift and to really rethink, how can I do this best taking advantages of these new benefits?
If we start to talk about cloud native architectures, the focus is purely and simply on code. It's not on the data. And DBAs, with the best will in the world, are resistant to changes of architecture because any mistake and that's everything down the toilet. How easy is it to get them to think about changing this issue of clusters, for example?
It's a bit of a shift, but what you'll see is as technologies like Spark evolve, we're giving them a lot of the familiar tools that they know and love from their traditional databases. So this morning in the keynote, we talked about improved cataloging and federation in Spark, ACID transactions, standard DML like update, delete, and merge. I think all of those things are making them more comfortable, even though this is an exotic new architecture.
I think it's going to be fun for some of them.
Yeah, definitely.
Michael, thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much.